Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Small Wonder, the afternoon event. And I'm delighted to be able to introduce Polly Sampson, closest to me, and Alison McLeod, who's chairing this afternoon's session. As you can see, and I'm sure some of you have already been made aware, unfortunately, Sarah Hall hasn't been able to join us due to medical reasons. However, although this is a great loss, the bonus is, and it's a very real bonus, that we can have some more and we can hear some more from Polly and also from Alison. So there's a silver cloud to the lining. Polly Sampson's second collection of short stories, Perfect Lives, was published last year to great acclaim. An insightful review from Maggie O'Farrell reads, "With her effortless prose and unflinching eye, Sampson dips beneath the surface of apparently contented, even blessed lives, and the result is compelling, disturbing, and moving." And actually, on the way in, Polly just told me that the collection is going to be serialized from the 7th of November, I think it is, on the book at bedtime slot. So that's something to look forward to. Polly's previous collection of short stories, this isn't her debut collection, her previous collection was Lying in Bed, and that was followed by a novel, Out of the Picture. Polly's also written successful song lyrics and has a background in publishing and journalism. Alison McLeod, who's chairing this session, is a novelist and a short story writer and also Professor of Contemporary Fiction at Chichester University, where she specialises in teaching the art of the short story. So it's a particularly appropriate opportunity to have a conversation and a more extended conversation between the two of them. So the structure of this afternoon's event, I'm in a minute, going to hand over to Alison. What will happen is that Alison will then just say a few words, then Polly is going to read her story from the collection The Egg. They then will have their conversation, and then Polly will end with her story Morgana. So I'm delighted to welcome them both again and to hand over to Alison.
Thanks ever so much, Diana. It's, again, wonderful to be back here at Small Wonder. And it's a particular pleasure to be here introducing Polly Sampson's collection, Perfect Lives. I'm absolutely delighted. It's a collection I was hugely looking forward to this year, read over the last couple of weeks, and as a both writer of short stories and as a huge reader of short stories, enjoyed it enormously. So I'm really myself looking forward to being in conversation with Polly to begin to unravel some of the exquisite things she's doing. And for me, it is just that. Perfect Lives is, I've just sort of made little notes to myself, an exquisite and, in my view, very poignant study of happiness, above all, of the moments of ordinary life when we seem to grasp happiness, and maybe more frequently, perhaps, of those moments when it eludes our very best efforts. Behind the apparently pleasing and even privileged lives of Polly's characters, we glimpse broken hearts and broken bodies, painful histories, and sometimes feelings that are perhaps too taboo even to be spoken, but they are evoked very beautifully. In one story, for example, a woman wears long sleeves and long gloves to hide the number that was forcibly tattooed on her wrist, obviously in Germany in the Second World War. In another, a Polish community, we watch them, they risk freezing temperatures to attend mass in a barren field out of view of communist government eyes. And I absolutely love these very quiet revelations as much as I do the warmth and the huge humour that runs throughout the collection. So humour-wise, and they're just delicious moments. In the opening story, we see a young woman as she seems to fillet a statue in front of her future parents-in-law, as it turns out. It's absolutely brilliant comedy. In another, a young boy is convinced that his babysitter is a circus trapeze artist in a sparkly blue bra. And so throughout what I love about it as a writer, and I was constantly underlining little phrases as I read, just sort of almost gobbling them up. We get prose that is lush, it's sharp-eyed, and it's beautifully visceral. Polly's stories are, for me, as tender as they are bold. They surprise me with their honesty, and it seems to me that's, of course, the job of any great short story writer, and Polly is that. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing. She's about to read for us an extract from the first story in the collection, which is The Egg, and we'll just then go into a little bit more of an in-conversation between us. And then, as Diana said, Polly will close with an extract from another story. So with great pleasure, I hand over to Polly.
Gosh, thank you. I hope this will live up to that. what I thought I would do is read a couple of extracts from the first story, which might make sense when they're put together and give a sense of the whole story. So it's a story about a woman called Celia Idlewild, and when we first meet her, we're very much given the impression that her life really is about as perfect as a life can be, and she's preparing breakfast for her family. She looked back up the stairs quickly to check that there was still no one coming. She thought she heard a door opening, so shot to the kitchen for a cloth. Normally, she would wear rubber gloves for anything involving a dishcloth, but on the occasion of the egg, she couldn't wait to get the mess off the floor and out of sight, away into a carrier bag, cloth and all, knotted in the way people do when disposing of nappies, and deep into the bin. Sorry, what I should have said is that the egg has been posted through her letterbox. She sat at the table and started working her way through the pot of coffee alone. The egg had reduced the crystalline possibility of her morning to slime. The domed shell of it in that smear of sunset, the crispy sound of it crushing inside the dishcloth as she closed her fist. Slime and shell, egg bomb, stink bomb, bombshell. Sometimes, too much caffeine could bring on an annoying twitch, just the outer corner of her right eye. Look quick. Outside, the sea rose in foam and dashed itself onto the shore. In a dark grey sky, white gulls battled the wind. Not then the sort of day that should bring a visitor to the coast. Celia used to watch her twitch in the mirror. Graham claimed he couldn't see it when she tried to get him to notice. He wasn't quick enough. Blink and you miss it. Tickety-tick. His eyes slid away back beneath the brim of his hat. Not nervy like her. Steady and kind. So he'd hate to think that he'd been the one to put the tick in there. She'd always been quick to flinch, like a horse that was easily spooked. She gulped the last of the coffee, feeling it hit her insides, shut her eyes. Graham, upstairs in bed, she'd take up the coffee, the tray on the floor, him turning onto his back. Through the window, despite the bad weather, three kite surfers galloping over the waves, powerful backs and legs hinging up and down like well-oiled machinery, and Graham's strong hands keeping her steady, sails billowing, rising and falling, crashing and skimming. But the egg. Her fingers tapped the work surface as a sermon on the radio reached its happy conclusion. It was, as these things so often are, about forgiveness, and she hadn't listened to a word of it. No point crying over a broken egg, she told herself. The whole family together, and people for lunch later. A good leg of lamb, and white peaches for Bellinis beforehand. She thought about starting again. A fresh pot of coffee, maybe squeezing some oranges. She summoned a picture, one of her favourites. Graham from the early days, the fading light of the Idlewild's garden, running away from him between dark green hedges of clipped box, a summer's night. Come here and let me kiss you, and skitting away across the lawn, laughing, allowing him to catch her and pretending to struggle as he kissed her. Holding hands, she in the loveliest yellow cotton dress, the belt was like a daisy chain. Him pulling her onto an octagon of lawn in the furthest reach of the Idlewild's jewel-box garden, a scented paradise wrought even lovelier by time. The setting sun gilding their limbs and flowers overflowing like baubles, glowing hypnotically against the green of the hedges, impossibly tall hollyhocks, shimmery-stemmed, silver leaves of artemisia, and roses, geraniums and lilies, rubies, garnets and pearls. "Kiss me back or I'll bite you," he said, growling into her ear, backing her against the only tree, a golden russet with rusty leaves and fruit as hard and round as little brass knobs. She let him bite her neck. "Kiss me and I'll tell you a secret." Never, she said, and turning her face away. Something I've never told anyone before. We never eat the fruit from this tree, by the way, he said, looking up into its branches, keeping his knee pressing her against its trunk. He held her arms above her head. I think you'd better promise me you won't, he said as sternly as he could muster. He could make her promise anything just by kissing her. She could feel the bark against the back of her hands, and through the leaves, two marble statues, their heads turning towards the tree. Adam and Eve, garlands falling from their hair, blind eyes beseeching. Okay, she laughed. I won't eat the fruit if you tell me your secret. And he blew a little warm air into her ear. Do you think we'll get a chance to, you know what, while we're here, she said. Will they really make me sleep in the tower room on my own? He kissed her. Okay, a secret, he said, when the kissing was done, though his knee stayed where it made her ache. It's about Eve. He nodded to the statue. Eve stared reproachfully back at them from her pedestal. Something I've never told anyone before. The serpent had been carved winding up Eve's leg. Its head reached rather suggestively beyond her knee. She was 4 feet tall, 5 with her pedestal, naked but for a fig leaf, an apple in the upturned marble fingers of her right hand. It's such pure white stone, Celia said, trying not to let it show that she could barely speak as he brushed his lips along her neck. No one had ever had this effect on her before. Is it English? She managed to squeak. She had a vague recall of something from her art history course in Florence. Didn't all the best marble come from Italy in the 18th century? Graham let go of her and sprang away. He stood grinning at her from behind Eve. His hands covered the statue's breasts, and Celia felt a spiteful jolt that took her by surprise. I used to love her bare bosoms when I was a boy, he said, laughing, pretending to tenderly caress them, until she felt that she would like to kick the statue over. Sometimes in the holidays she was the first thing I'd think of when I got home. Celia stuck her tongue out at him. Well, I rather fancy Adam, she retorted. And then, wildly for her, because she rarely let down her guard, she threw herself at the hideously veined feet of the Adam statue and knelt, kissed his knees, then his bulging thighs, and finally aimed her mouth at his well-placed marble fig leaf. She mimed with her lips to the cold stone. Celia! As though her mouth was full. Celia, said Graham again, but with greater urgency. She moaned louder still, pretending to pull Adam closer, her hands running up and down the cold ridges of his stomach. Celia, stop, Graham hissed. But still it took her far too long to register that standing there, along with the elderly local doctor and his wife, were Graham's parents. All four of them affecting coughs. Ah, yes, musk roses, his mother was saying, fluttering her hand at her chest. Commissioned by my grandfather, Graham's father told her, completely deadpan, because he thought this place was like Eden. Well, while she smoothed down her skirt, well, it is like paradise, she said, chattering, holding out her hand to be shaken. All the flowers and the lovely grass and the view and, oh yes, hello, it's very nice to meet you too. Oh, they're going to love you, I can tell, Graham said, after they'd been left alone, tactfully, but not without tangible reproach, together in Adam and Eve's garden. But Celia knew that she would never be lovely in their eyes. Despite becoming the provider of two unimpeachably marvellous grandchildren, she was always a little bit the slattern in the yellow dress, who came up for the weekend from London, shocked the natives, fellated their statue, and won their only son. And then I thought I'd read just another little bit, which is now a memory which has jumped forward about 20 years, and Celia has created a beautiful party on the beach in front of their glorious house for Graham's 40th birthday. There was lean roast beef and potato salad, bottles lodged in silver buckets of ice. There was a birthday cake, candles. Celia suddenly found herself craving a cigarette. Instead, she set about clearing up the old coffee grounds, using the side of her hand to push them on top of the plastic bag that contained the egg mess. The 40 golden birthday candles were never lit. So, would you press the red button, then? A handsome young dandy who'd been brought along, a friend of a friend. He was wearing a waistcoat that looked like it was made out of gold foil, and eyeing her suggestively as he took a swig from the neck of his beer. He said he wanted to know if she'd push a hypothetical red button that would make all her dreams come true if it meant exterminating an anonymous Chinaman in the process. No one would know you'd done it, he said, now quite openly flirting, running his knuckles along her arm. I wouldn't tell anyone. But all my dreams have already come true, said Celia, laughing, pulling her arm away to gesture up at her house, standing tall and creamily stuccoed above the beach like a lone tooth. A woman in tight jeans scrunched towards them across the stones, talking to Graham. Bright lipstick, shoes too high for the beach, but rather than take them off like everyone else, she had to keep hanging off Graham to steady herself. This way for cold beer, he said, introducing the bucket of ice and Celia in one wave of his arm, or maybe champagne, thanks to my beautiful wife. Beautiful wife. He always knew when to reassure her. This is Celia, he said, and this, Rachel, you may have met before. Oh, I don't think so, said Celia, but maybe. The flirtatious man with the hypothetical red button offered to open some champagne to wash down the oysters. I'm not sure we've met before either, but I did set eyes on your gorgeous daughter yesterday morning, said Rachel, claiming her attention. There was lipstick on two of her incisors. What a sweetie, watching her in her Connaught wife's uniform, so little with that great big satchel, bobbing up and down on the end of Graham's arm. What, said Celia, about to laugh? The man in the foil waistcoat was being comically inept with the champagne bottle. He had it wedged between his knees. Yes, I stopped at the crossing. I hadn't realised you had one so young. Graham had gone puce. Our daughter goes to school down the road from here. Not London, said Celia. She goes on the bus. It wasn't me, he said. Oh, yeah, you were wearing a long dark green coat and... Celia stared at him. He was like a beetroot beneath the cream Panama. A proper Borsellino it was. They'd bought it together in Milan at Easter. She would never find him handsome in a Panama again. Don't you remember? I waved, Rachel continued, as though now she'd started she couldn't stop. She seemed to have become swept up, for she couldn't have missed the tempest in Celia's blue eyes. It takes just one thing, a freak in the weather, a bit of a rage, a tsunami snatching people up from the shore like Jack's in its giant fist, a thermal maelstrom, the wrong sneeze, the bad geography where tectonic plates rub themselves into a frenzy, or a Rachel at a party who can casually shatter a perfect life with a few words.
Can everyone hear us all right? Is the volume okay? Great. So, Polly, that's a stunning story to begin with, and perhaps really appropriate as a first extract for us to hear, our first couple of extracts, because there is this notion of paradise, yeah, isn't there, behind the collection. I was sort of fascinated by the different takes on happiness and the, you know, many of the characters are sort of exploring, you know, is happiness within their reach? If they had it, as we've just seen with Celia, she thought she had it, and it's sort of blown sky high with the briefest of conversations. I'm curious, in terms of your writing of the collection, were you aware that was a preoccupation, that was going to be a sort of thread between the stories? And we'll talk about many ways in which the stories are threaded, but to begin there with that, I mean, there's some lovely bits. I've just noticed, you know, later a character says, when people get what they want, they haven't got a clue what to do with it. I think that's Aurelia who says that later. And then Morgana's wondering, were we ever really happy? You know. Yeah. So I'm curious how that...
Well, I think all my preoccupations are only revealed after,
yes,
after,
yes,
I've written the,
yeah,
stories.
Of course.
And I suppose that I've thought about it since and realised that, you know, happiness is very fleeting and that, you know, it is quite important to hang on to... There are sublime moments that do seem perfect in a life.
Yeah.
But then, you know, no one's life can possibly be perfect. And the other thing that links many of the characters is that, for example, Celia's life is ruined by the idea of perfection, because what happens with Celia is that she's determined to cling on to the idea that her life and her marriage is perfect, and she will not countenance the idea that anything bad has happened, that there could be anything that is sort of dirty or smudgy within this beautiful version of her life.
Yeah.
And so she becomes a very rigid person and a very unhappy person.
Yeah.
And so what has to happen is that she has to sort of accept and really think about this terrible revelation, and not just bury it under the carapace.
Right, yeah. That's, and that, you know, her brittleness and the sort of brittle beauty of their home,
yes,
comes across, you know.
So she eats brittle food.
Yes, she does.
Things.
She's very
and
brittle.
I don't do them on purpose.
No, of course not. But
then afterwards people say, oh, did you specially, you know, choose the food to fit the characters? And you kind of go back and you think, well, subconsciously maybe.
Yeah. But nobody does note cards, do they? No, nobody does note cards. So these preoccupations emerge through a collection. And I mean, I'm you know, as a writer and reader, intrigued by that, the way in which we're revealed to ourselves, yes, really, as we write, and we discover, you know, what it is that intrigues us.
Yes.
In the lovely passage you read, I'm sorry, I sort of did a slight spoiler there, in my intro about the fellatio and so on. Oops. But there are also, of course, what we haven't yet said, or I haven't yet said, is that this is a collection of linked short stories. And I, again, looking at it in a writerly way, I was fascinated by the almost echo chamber you create of characters, this great constellation of characters who move in and out of each other's stories. And in a way, one feels as a reader that we begin to perhaps know them better than they know themselves, because we've seen them from... they almost become cubist, you know, like a cubist painting. We're seeing them from these different points of view. So I'm wondering again where that began. Why are linked? You know, yes. Again, I know it's one of these difficult to go back to things.
Yes. Again, it wasn't entirely deliberate. Mm. It was very character led. The first story that I wrote in the collection, and in fact, it was the first story I'd written for years, was a story about a piano tuner and. In the course of his day tuning pianos, he goes to the houses of, in fact, he goes to Celia Idlewild's,
yes,
house, and he goes to Morgana's house, and we'll hear about her later. And I finished that story, and I was happy with it, and I put it aside. And then I started thinking, well, you know, I'd quite like to write another one now. And years ago, I went, I was photographing an audience at a concert in Hamburg, and I was at the back of the stage, and the audience was sort of cheering for an encore. And my father is Jewish and came on the Kindertransport in 1938 from Hamburg, and his mother got out as late as May 1939, and the family lost all, you know, everything, and aunts went to concentration camps, and, you know, it was a terrible, terrible time, as we all know. But all I could think was that I really didn't want to go to Hamburg in the beginning, because it's that feeling of having been robbed of your ancestry.
Sure.
And then when I did go to Hamburg, and I was absolutely fine until this moment when I lifted the camera and tried to take a photograph of the audience. And they were young people clamoring, and they had absolutely nothing to apologize for, and yet I felt they really owed me an apology, and I, in that instant, hated these people. And so I kind of put down the camera and then started thinking about it, and that feeling had stayed with me because it's a very inappropriate feeling.
Mm.
And so I thought that would be quite a good thing to explore in a story. And then I started sort of thinking, well, you know, who could be playing concert?
Mm.
And there are lots of pianos in this book. And
lots
one of the reasons
of pianos,
I hadn't written for years was that I'd become obsessed with learning and playing the piano. And so I thought, well, it'd be rather fun to make, you know, to make her a concert pianist. So I need a Jewish concert pianist. And then I realized that one of the people in the story that I'd just finished was called Lieberman.
Yes.
And she was having her piano, you know, and I sort of thought, well, there she is.
There she
and it was
is.
Almost, with each of the stories, it was almost as though a character just stuck up a hand at the end and said, hello, here I am, it's me next.
Yeah, so it's almost as if somehow, I don't know, and I'm not sure about you, but as when I'm writing short stories, I often think if I'm stuck or I don't know what the next thing is, somehow it's like Chinese boxes already contained within the story you've written.
Yes.
And somehow that reveals between the lines, there's something there that tells you what you need to do next. And that would seem to be the case with Lieberman as a name.
And it's so enjoyable. It's such
a
lovely moment when that happens.
And in fact,
this book, it just kept happening. It just kept happening that people presented
themselves. Kept revealing themselves and then in relationship to someone else. So, for anyone who hasn't yet read the collection, you know, on the whole, we're looking at a group of families on the whole, within a sort of seaside town. And little by little, they emerge in sort of relationship to one another, friends of families, piano tuner of family, children of the family who begin, and little by little, everything's just sort of turned slightly more and more around until we have this, beautiful wide view of all of those characters that you didn't expect when you first came across them in a short story. So, it is this sort of wonderful flux of perspectives, and I absolutely love that. It's something you also just said. You said that you had that feeling in Hamburg, a feeling that you shouldn't have had.
Yes.
And It seems to me one thing that really jumped out was I love your characters. Many of them are having feelings they shouldn't be having. And you know, that we have Tilda, a new mother, who, again, not to say too much of the story, but who has a new baby, and she looks down at him and thinks he looks like a Christmas gammon, and a bright red Christmas gammon, and when he's first born. And she doesn't have, you know, it's a sort of buried taboo in the centre of the story. She's not allowed to speak of that. Really, she has virtually no connection with her new baby.
I thought that was worth exploring.
Yeah.
So many women have this pressure. It's supposed to be like falling in love, and for so many women, it really isn't like falling in love.
It takes a while. and you know, we won't say whether she gets there or not. That sense of what can't be said is there, or what can't be done, and you explore it comically, as in the extract you just read. There's also a bit where I think it's Richard thinking back to his father at his Richard the piano tuner, who began as an incredibly talented concert pianist, and we go back to the memory of stage fright when things failed for him, and there's this wonderful burst of, and again you feel that, wow, that shouldn't, that's what I mean by the terrific honesty of your work. You feel as if, oh, that shouldn't have been said, but you think, oh my gosh, of course, when he, this is this burst on the page of dog face, I think it's his father, he's talking about his father, whom he sort of loathes, really, for good reason, and suddenly in this wonderful passage of prose about that particular concert, this paragraph that just bursts out. And are you quite instinctive as, I mean, I'm sensing that you probably are.
Nothing is ever planned. I have no idea what the next sentence is.
So your characters are quite alive for you in your head, then?
It's almost like method
possession.
Acting.
Right, yes, I guess, yes, method acting, yes, I can imagine. So you're almost sort of like carrying them around
walk,
with you.
As that sounds so mad.
No,
but I have
not
to go, I write a bit, and then as that character, I go for a walk.
So you're carrying the character with you, literally, almost physically. Almost channeling, in a sense.
Yes.
As mad as that sounds.
Yes.
No. And I think, you know, any writers in the room will completely understand that feeling.
Yeah.
And then you send them out. I think in interview, you know, you at one point, you know, yes, I send them out into the world, sort of independent, but quite alive, really.
Yeah.
It was just the strange sort of uncanny element of writing, really. In going back to the linked stories, you mentioned the yellow cotton dress, and again, what's the beauty of it? It seems to me there are all these, not even motifs, so that would sound too self-conscious, perhaps, but there are these lovely echoes again of images, which almost become musical in some way that I can't quite explain, but sort of refrains that come in and out. So, for example, the yellow cotton dress with the daisy chain belt that Polly referred to in her reading, that we get yellow cotton dresses coming in.
Well, we get the same yellow cotton dress because another character, a sort of teenager, buys it from a charity shop. I can't remember, did she get it from eBay now? She got it second hand, and she wears it with old Dr. Martens.
Yes.
And I really, that was sort of a gleeful moment because I thought, ha ha ha, now I'll be able to tell whether my friends have really read it.
Whether they got to the end, whether they got to the final stories. And there are other things, and we've got a parrot who comes in and out, pianos, as you say, move through many of the stories. And again, returning to the section you read and the cover, breasts, you know, I found it very moving, really. What you do with the body, I found it extremely moving. That at one point a woman just, you know, we've got Graham reaching for the breast, as is illustrated here on the statue, and having a nice sort of copping a feel. But then there are all sorts of touches. Just the body's done so beautifully and so simply. But at one point a woman is just resting, you know, for comfort. She just rests. She puts her hand on her robe while she's thinking. Just rests her arm on her hand on her breast. There's a moment where at the end of a demo in London, after all the chaos of the demo in London, a woman just needs to feed her baby. And then there's a story later about breast cancer, and we'll say no more than that. But so there's this, is the body for you, Cesar? You're also a photographer, and I'm very, you know, very interested in that, really. Is that, again, is that something that preoccupies you, just the physicality?
Yes, I suppose it must do.
Yeah. Again, I know...
This is someone pointed out there are an awful lot of blowjobs in this book as well.
Yes, I mean, I wasn't going to go there, but I was sticking to breasts and blowjobs.
When I'm writing from the point of view of a man, I was very conscious, two or three from the point of view of men, and I started to sort of try to look at bodies through the eyes of men, and I realised that men maybe looked at women as parts.
Right.
I think women see people more as the whole. And I just developed this theory that men are much more conscious of parts.
I think science backs you up on that.
Oh, does it?
I think it does. I'm afraid so. I think it does.
And so that was really good fun to sort of introduce another character called Anna, who we meet through the eyes of Richard, the piano tuner, and to just sort of have him notice really odd little details about her body, you know, her earlobe,
yes,
the particular
earlobe,
shape of her earlobe.
I have an earlobe like a tender as a bean.
Yeah.
And and he notices her clavicle, her collarbone, like a bow.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely exquisite. Yeah. I'm curious to know, you know, who were your great inspirations? I was wondering about Angela Carter, for example.
I love Angela Carter.
I wondered that because I thought you've got her boldness as well as her precision. And you know, I was wondering if this you mentioned, I think, in an interview that your parents were always reading, not even, I think, telling you stories, not necessarily even reading, but making up.
Yes, I was really lucky.
Because
I can't, it's a really odd thing. You'd think that if you write fiction that you'd be really good at making up stories for your children, and I'm really not good at making up stories for my children, and I do feel it's a bit of a failing. And both of my parents, when I was little, they really did make up stories every night, and you know, my mother had one set of characters and my father had another set of characters, and it was really really exciting.
Wow.
I think some of them got written down, and and my mother still does it. I mean, writes little books for my children, and you know, fills in the great gap left by my useless failure.
Well, it's true, isn't it? Because story writers aren't necessarily storytellers. It's not. Someone said to me once, "Oh no, it's, you know, I can tell a story, but I can never write one." I think it's the difference between being somebody who's perhaps quite extrovert and able to put something out there, and then other writers are real observers and hang back and you know, it's a different mindset in an interesting way. There's something on the tip of my tongue I was thinking of as you just said, if we, you know, you're talking about, you know, you're referring to your children, and I know you've got between children and stepchildren eight.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, it's quite a clue. It's amazing.
A lot of stories I didn't read. Read, but,
and in the story, the birthday present, the narrator in that is a very keen photographer, and there is, we sense in a way, I think, well, perhaps all writers who have children, but I certainly know many women writer friends of mine that will sense that sort of the struggle at times to balance all that and to do both well.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering how you've managed it to some extent.
Well, I haven't written for 10 years. I think that was the main way I've managed it.
Well, you're doing lyrics. And
I find writing and small children, well, actually even bigger children, almost impossible because I'm so obsessive.
Yes.
So which is why I was asking you about teaching and writing as a combination, which I think must be so difficult.
It's very absorbing, yeah.
And I can only write when I'm writing.
Exactly.
It's as if I go into a mode and that is all I can do. I mean, I'm in the middle of writing something at the moment, and I just yesterday thought, well, I can't possibly go and do this because I'm writing.
I know, it's really hard to surface.
So absolutely absorbing, and I think it's so hard to get into it that you're very, very reluctant to get out.
Yeah.
And I can remember one time, you know, I can't remember if it was this book must have been the novel, and I wrote the novel it was a sort of mania because I had the whole thing in my head.
Yes.
And I ended up writing it in 6 weeks.
Yes.
And I can remember at one point during this sort of mania of writing, my husband coming up and saying, come on, we've got to go now. You've got to get to parents' evening. And I looked at him sort of tears and said, why do I have to go to parents' evening?
Mm.
And he looked appalled and said, well, you're a parent.
By the way, incidentally. It is. I think it was actually here at Small Wonder. I still remember a line that Hilary Mantel said about that process when you're absolutely absorbed. And she described it as a fire. It's as if this is fire was eating all the the oxygen in the room, and you can only stay with it. So yes, okay, so things get slowed down a little bit, but life is full and rich, and there's obviously material from the richness. And thinking about the stars again, I was also curious, because I believe I read that in terms of, and this will be of interest to writers who are thinking about the sequences in their own collections, I believe your editor had a slightly different sequence in mind initially. Yes. Is that true?
Yes, she wanted to start with the piano tuner. I mean, and it's a good place to start because you meet so many of the other characters through him. But I really didn't want to start with a depressed man in an anorak eating a ham sandwich. I just thought, you know, people pick up a book. I'm not sure it's the best introduction to these people.
Right.
So I just put the egg first because I thought she.
It's quite sensual.
Yes, it's
full of life and full of
and
richness.
And actually, I now wouldn't have it any other. I mean, I think it was the right decision.
I was thinking, there's such you've really begun, you know, as a reader to enjoy all the richness and lushness of that, you know, the paradise scene, and then. It's, you know, it is such impact at the end of that story. It's so, you know, it's so striking, and one doesn't expect things to go wrong at all the way they go wrong, and just to hinge on the simplest of moments, as of course.
Although it's, it goes very right at the end.
It does go very right at the end. It does go very right at the end. So again, one feels sort of confident enough about these you know, characters' lives to move forward. I'm trying to think. I'm not expert enough in any way to discuss it, but I know you also write lyrics. And your work's been called extremely poetic. And I mentioned a few of the lines. And I just had to copy them down just out of sheer pleasure, just to give the audience perhaps a slightly little nuggets of your prose. They're just such beautiful phrases, Polly. The lilting possibilities of the afternoon, or there are children who are described as joyous and sleek as porpoises in bright water. Or there's a man at one point lowering the lid of a piano, and he lowers it as gently as a man closing a coffin. And I think the prose is economic, it's sharp, it's not drawing attention to itself. Yet there's this great, this beautiful lyricism, for lack of a better word. And I'm wondering if again, your scribbling lines, if those sorts of lines might come to you as separate images and then grow into a story. Where do your stories begin?
I constantly keep notes.
You do,
But actually, I then never refer to them. But the sheer act of writing them down somehow. I don't know if you find this, but it means that they then do come when I need them.
I think it's almost like an act of training your mind to be receptive and not to let little glimmers that we all see every day pass us by. It's a training in a certain kind of receptivity, isn't it? To be alert to the world.
Yeah.
There's a terrific sense of alertness to the world and the detail of it, which is, you know, perhaps photographic, painterly, poetic.
I'm frustrated because I didn't write for 10 years. And so I was, you know, there was a lot of observing things and thinking, oh, I'd love to put that into something.
Right.
And sort of making it either a mental or a physical note. And so in a way, it was quite nice to have, I mean, I've written so little over 10 years, but there was some sort of wealth of stuff that, you know, I was sort of desperate to
use. So it's bursting. Yeah. And that's the best place to be in writing, isn't it? Almost to be at a sort of brink of frustration. And somehow that, you know, it's good to remember, isn't it, when we're really feeling quite frustrated or desperate about time to write. And in some way, though, perhaps that galvanizes things and you know, pushes it out and makes it happen. We're going to hear a little bit from Morgana, the story of Morgana. So this was one of my favorites. And again, there's a line in it. Well, there are many lines in it, but there was something about Morgana. So can you just tell us a little bit about the character of Morgana?
Okay. I can tell you where she came from, because this is one I do know where she absolutely came from.
And it's great to hear where a particular story comes from, how it arrives.
Well, she already existed for me because she'd been in the story with the piano tuner. And I was intrigued by her because she was a very minor character. She was just to represent the idea of the sort of people who have a piano and don't really play it, and how frustrating that is for a man who loves to play the piano. But at the same time, I had three very good friends who'd all been married for a long, long time, and all three, their husbands had run off with younger women. And because I was sort of available late at night. I became the repository for all their unhappiness. And at first I was incredibly sympathetic and you know, and as the year went on and they still didn't seem to be over these men, who they didn't even really like when they were married to them. I mean, just the obsession with their every movement. And all three women were stalking these men. It was the most extraordinary thing. And I started to just find it very funny. And so I didn't want to be cruel, but what I did want to do, because what I couldn't understand was why suddenly these men were imbued with such importance.
And power.
They'd been nothing but, you know, inconvenient for the last sort of 10 years. And so I kind of wanted to write a sort of good riddance to the bad rubbish story.
Absolutely compelling, because one feels the voyeur in the story, one feels, well, as the narrator is, really, because the narrator is more or less, for a time, enabling Morgana to do her stalking, especially by allowing her to use her car, and of course, it all gets quite alarming as Morgana's driving but trying to stalk at the same time, and so driving really pretty precariously. But one, again, this is, seems to me what is absolutely striking about your work is that we feel we're looking at something we almost shouldn't be seeing, but it's absolutely human and absolutely recognisable. And it's, again, that shock of honesty that I think is the hallmark of any great short story. And I certainly felt that with Morgana. Because I'm just looking at my own little notes. Again, you'll see my copy. This is what I do for writers' books I love. And I'm just, they all get, you know, badly. Do you do that? So they all get really badly marked up. I desecrate books I love. And this one is, you know, this was all completely marked up, desecrated. We're kind of like a mess of it, really, going through and little lines. So, you know, so I don't know if that makes it more collectible, Polly, or less collectible. I suspect less, but never mind.
I think it makes it much more interesting. I love coming across people's scribbles.
Well, because you feel, as I think particularly with a short story, it's such an intimate form that you feel you're really... in dialogue with the characters, there's something so immediate. There's a voice in your ear. It's somehow closer than many a novel. And so, yes, I suppose it's that feeling I'm in conversation. I'm just looking at one of your notes. What have I written down here? It was a strange moment when she's looking at her husband, Mike, and I won't say what state Mike's in, but Morgana looks down at her
son. Well, don't ruin it.
I won't ruin it. No, it's your leave it. Okay. All right. It's so good. I'm going to just let you read it. That's what it is. You can read it. Sorry, everyone. You're going to read that. I'm not going to say it then. It's so wonderful. I'm not going to say it then. So what I'll do instead is invite Polly, and say, again, with great pleasure. We'll hear a little bit from Morgana.
Okay. Two little bits.
Great. Wonderful.
So
one stalking bit and then something from the end. I mean, the stalking goes on much longer than this in the story, but I thought I'd give you a flavour. I called for her on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 2:30 in the afternoon, so we had a clear hour to mow down pedestrians before I had to collect my pair of boys from their school. The mornings would have suited me just as well, but she told me she was still finding it hard to raise herself, what with the great weight of her soul pressing on her chest as soon as she opened her eyes. So heavy, she said, it felt like it had been ripped from her in the night and plonked there, filled with rubble. She often spoke of her soul, and I imagined it lowering down on her in her silk swag chamber, heavy and bowed with grief, a long candle burning, and through the bay windows a view all the way to the horizon, only a road and the promenade between the former marital bed and the ocean. Talk at home was all tractors, Lego and cheese strings, 3/7 to 21, and the thrilling adventures of Biff and Chip, only the occasional grunt or sigh from Simon. My cat had more to say than my husband these days, and now that the more unpredictable brick-throwing phase was over, a couple of episodes a week of Morgana's drama was, I came to realise, just what the doctor ordered. Though Morgana claimed her soul was in torment, she never failed to cheer me up. Sometimes I'd feel my poor Peugeot quake. A variety of stimuli could set Morgana off. An alabaster statuette spied through his window, flaunting its nakedness atop his new desk. Do you think it reminds him of her? CDs, a book spotted lying on the back seat of his car, a thick one with an irritating title. The man on the cover looked to be in fear of his life, she said, rattling my keys at the ignition irritably. What's he doing reading self-help books? I had more or less given up trying to dissuade Morgana from making these detours up Mike's road. Her innocent request for driving practice had very soon taken on a Thelma and Louise-style urgency all of its own. Our route usually took us by his flat, and there were forays past his studio, down by the lighthouse too, where occasionally she parked with a vantage point to his assistant carrying lighting rigs in and out. Shamefully, we often took off along the seafront to pass the rehearsal hall where Elizabeth, his girlfriend, sometimes went to play her oboe. The one time we saw her walking along the street, oh, it was a carefree ponytail swinging sort of a walk. Morgana squealed like a schoolgirl with a crush and ducked down into her own lap, despite the fact that she was the one who was actually driving. And I had to grab the wheel or we would have crashed. Sometimes, Morgana told me, she couldn't sleep at night, and in the darkness she tiptoed quite undetected through the perfumed gardens of Elizabeth's Facebook. Elizabeth seemed to have accepted Morgana's alter ego as a friend. I said it just proved how few friends she had in the real world. Bang outside Mike's flat and into a space either directly behind or directly in front of his car always seemed to Morgana to be the perfect place to practice parking. The curtains were drawn at the front. They had been since the last time he'd allowed her over the threshold, and much to Elizabeth's displeasure and Morgana's later mortification, she and Mike had ended up wrestling on the floor like bad children. Once parked, Morgana was able to nip out and search for those little sharp nuggets of information that she so craved, peering through the windows of his black Audi. I watched her with her hands against the glass of the car that had once been her chariot, and cringed as I imagined Elizabeth or Mike seeing her there. Awaken the giant within! What's that supposed to mean? When did he ever read books like that? She huffed as we pulled away in a series of ostrich jerks. Mirrors! Mirrors! I yelled. Silly little girl must be telling him what to read. Self-help. Her bracelets jangled as she thumped the steering wheel for emphasis. He never had any trouble helping himself, ignoring the hooting from the car behind. What do you suppose I did to his giant anyway to put it to sleep? She scraped the gears as she changed into third. Sorry, she said to me and to the man who'd overtaken, shaking his head. And he's listening to the ting-tings. What's he doing, listening to the ting-tings? So then the stalking goes on a bit. And then Mike goes with Elizabeth, his girlfriend, lovely young Elizabeth, on a cycling holiday in Scotland. And he falls off his bike, and the bang on his head is so serious that he's airlifted to hospital, and his memory has gone, and he's been calling for Morgana. And of course she goes. He was propped up in bed, foolish and massively bruised, with a bandage wrapped around his head like a turban. Elizabeth was sitting on a chair at his bedside, his obedient handmaiden, fingers knotted together in her lap. She stood up when Morgana was brought in. Morgana could see that Elizabeth's hands were shaking. She watched as she opened her mouth to speak, but Mike's cries of, "Morgana, my love, thank God you're here," silenced her. Elizabeth was shivering all over like a whippet. The nurse, who had shown such kindness when she told Morgana where to go, placed her hands around Elizabeth's thin cashmere wrists, looked into her eyes. "Don't worry," she said, "this sometimes happens." And Morgana felt like muttering, "Turncoat." Elizabeth's voice was shaky when she found it. The caliph groaned and reached out his arms to Morgana, who found herself being pulled by him onto the bed, even treading on Elizabeth's toe as she was being swept up. She found herself in his arms with her head on his chest, and she couldn't resist catching her breath there for a while, like coming home after being carried by a wave of nostalgia so powerful that it almost made her cry out. Elizabeth's words were lost to them both in the maelstrom, but there was the sound of her voice shouting from the shore, and then the slap of her shoes as she flounced from the room and along the corridor to the nurse's station. "Looking for reinforcements," said Morgana wickedly. Morgana ran Mike a bath, testing it with her elbow in the way she'd tested it for their children. She promised to be gentle as she helped him from the bed. He looked uncomfortable in the bath, a bit wary, all hunched up like that and stained by a great map of a bruise running from his ear through his shoulder and across his ribs. It wasn't a hot bath, but beads of perspiration started breaking out all over his face beneath the bandage. A second wave broke over her with even more force than the first. It came rushing up, taking her by surprise, dashing nostalgia on the rocks. Here he was, luxuriating in a bath because he'd banged his head. Their daughter was susceptible to lung problems. It came from being born 12 weeks too early. All his fault. She was twisting the flannel in her hands as she thought about the night that Lola emerged from between her legs, mewling and helpless as a creature that had been freshly skinned. Mike seemed barely awake in the bath. The only person he ever paid for was Elizabeth. Everyone else had been dropped. "Will you give my back a scrub?" he murmured. From what she'd found out, he was currently subsidising a vanity project, a record Elizabeth hoped to make, just herself with synthesizers and oboe. Soap suds gathered like scum around sparse tufts of hair that sprouted randomly across his shoulders. She'd never noticed how hairy his back had become. She couldn't understand why Elizabeth wouldn't find him repulsive. She had a sudden urge to sink her nails as hard as she could into that wet, sparsely forested skin. Lola, brought on by the shock of some photographs she'd found 19 years ago, so long ago now she'd almost managed to forget the name of the girl. Anyway, there had been others since to forget. Once she found a poem and a tube of KY jelly in his wash bag and felt so tired that she didn't even mention it, only squeezed the jelly all over the poem, his toothbrush, his razor and the rest. Mike had to keep his bandaged knees and arms bent above the line of the water. His arms rested along the rim of the bath and his deflated pectorals hung pale, reminding her of chicken fillets in their loose skin. She wrung the water from the flannel, trying to avoid thinking of it as his neck, and slapped it 3 times across her wrist, enough to sting. Mike didn't appear to notice. He was practically asleep, the weight of his head and the bandages making his chin sink to his chest. A child couldn't escape a gestation cut short by 12 weeks without some sort of damage. Morgana's stomach turned at the sight of the hair in his armpits spread along the white rim of the hospital bath like the beards of mussels. Below, his scrotum bobbed slightly in the shallow water like giant figs. She imagined that this was how it would be to look at him through the eyes of Lucian Freud. The truth stripped bare. She could see the many blues and the purples of his skin, the places it was grey, all the varied shades of the abattoir. There was a tripe pallor to it in the soft places, too. She could see how his naked body would look when he died. There were parts of him she could see even further than that. Beneath the skin, the scar tissue bubbling up around his frozen shoulder, the stringy bits of contorted muscle beneath his navel where his hernia had been badly mended, the gathering fat closing in on itself in his arteries like an oyster making a pearl, but not beautiful. It was as instant as falling in love, she said. She couldn't stop smiling. Flocks of birds were taking off from inside her head. She remembered a trip they took years before to California, the vibrating beds in the hotels, how good it felt when they turned themselves off, the pleasure and peace as the thrumming stopped. She assisted him from the bath, left him helplessly dripping on the mat. There had been a little blood seepage from the bandage at his head, she noticed. A small red star had spread on one side like a jewel. She took a peach-coloured towel from the rail and wrapped it around him, an act of charity. Elizabeth was at the door. Oh, for God's sake, Morgana, stop! Elizabeth, the one with the puffy eyes, this time. Morgana carried on patting her husband dry. His bandaged head was against her, his face pressed into her stomach like a child to its mother. Elizabeth hissed at her, "You're sick!" "Shh," said Morgana, cradling his head and looking at Elizabeth over the top of it. Elizabeth disappeared from the doorway. Morgana could hear the slight complaint of springs as she flung herself onto the hospital bed. It appeared the nurses were staying out of it after all. She could hear Elizabeth sobbing, a childlike mule that caused a drop of pity to fall onto the parched earth of her soul. She helped Mike into the gown that had been thoughtfully provided by the hospital and sat him on the softly chintzed chair that the healthcare trust had so kindly installed in the room. "Christ, Morgana, my head is pounding," he said. "Do you think you could get that girl to stop crying?" Morgana threw back her head and laughed. Oh, no, sorry, I'm going to miss a bit out, actually. Mike was sitting in the chair. It's because it jumps about in time. Right. Mike was sitting in the chair, not looking quite so dazed. She handed him a clipboard from her bag and a pen. The steam had cleared from the room. Everything had come into sharp focus. The sound of Elizabeth weeping, the buzz of the fan, the big red emergency cord that she could still see through the doorway hanging by the bath, her heart ticking like a clock. On the clipboard, ready for him, was a policy for their daughter's health insurance, and that, she realised as he signed, was all she needed from him. Elizabeth was in the fetal position. She may even have been asleep. Morgana stopped for an instant, reached out a hand to the girl's cheek, was horrified when she flinched. "Everything will be all right," she said. Mike was leaning back a bit in the chair, his brow furrowed beneath the bandage as though with the effort of trying to catch more than glimpses of things that shimmered tantalizingly, minnowing in and out of his head. "I'd better run if I'm to catch the post office in time with this," said Morgana, tucking the policy safely into its envelope. Then she helped him up from the chair, and with Elizabeth's assistance, delivered him like an unwanted gift or something she'd bought by mistake in the wrong size back to his bed.
Thank you. Thank you, Polly. Thanks for having me. That was the bit that for me, that's an absolutely remarkable portrait of Mike in the bath. Absolutely. You can't look away. The flaps of skin, the chicken fillets, and how he will look, yes, dead. So it's, again, it's something one feels which one shouldn't be seeing, but it's absolutely human and moving, really, throughout the whole collection. It's never delivered cold. It's unflinching, but there's always a sort of tenderness around all of the stories that gives it this great human quality. So real pleasure for me to hear. Very quickly, before we turn the floor over to your questions, and perhaps just while you gather your questions, what I understand is and I know there are children, there are other things going on in life, but 8 years, is that true? 8 years in the writing? Ish.
It's yes. I mean, but
never 40. Not sort of 40 hours a week.
But I would say, a year of concentrated writing.
Yes. Are you a great redrafter? Do you draft and redraft
endlessly, endlessly, endlessly?
Right.
And then actually, my poor husband, because I have to. I don't know how many people do this, but I have to read aloud for the rhythm.
Yeah.
And so I will read the new draft to my husband and then say, so what did you think?
Yes.
And he'll either be asleep or he'll kind of snap to attention, and you can see him thinking, oh my God, what was different?
poor man. But it's true, in the reading aloud, you hear bum notes, don't you, that you don't see on the page.
Yeah.
And very often I think if the rhythm of a line goes off as you're reading it, it's not just that the rhythm's wrong, there's something wrong with that sentence.
Yeah. Yes.
And it shows you that.
Or if you feel sort of hot. If I get hot a bit, it feels like I think, oh no, that's not right, because I'm feeling kind of
something
bad.
Wrong in the reading of it, or it's too packed a sentence, or something like that. You're not getting your breath.
Yeah.
And there is that, again, to your lines, that wonderful musicality through so much of it, as I'm sure, we've just heard. I think let's open the floor. So there will be roving mics. And if you wouldn't mind just standing, so we have the best chance of hearing it. And I'm happy to repeat questions. So any questions that we have for a moment? Any questions about how Polly writes, different stages of writing and so on? Yes, just right here. Thank you for standing.
I really like the quote you were talking about the receptivity, particularly after writing. It seems like you had an awful lot of ideas and were very receptive to lots of things. Did that therefore equal a short story collection to put that out there? Was it a natural, this was the form you had to write at this stage, going back to writing now?
I assume everyone heard the question, but after a break from writing, when Polly's been not able to write, but has been very receptive to things perhaps she hasn't been able to get down in full story form, did that period of being away but being tuned in lead to something?
I have never had more fun than writing this book, and I think that was to do with the 8 years of thinking about it. I mean, there were one of the stories in here I had written in another version, another one I'd written in a different version for the radio.
Right.
So the great pleasure was to sort of rewrite those. But I think that yes, the 8 years of just ideas filtering and almost giving my imaginary friends a space to grow.
Yeah, and really, when I believe that at the moment on the wonderful short story review, it's an online review called The Short Review, I believe there's something up there at the moment about the time in which writers take. So about eight interviews, or eight little selections from interviews from various short story writers, anything from 4 years up to 20 years for a single short story collection. And on the one hand, that seems almost embarrassing to admit, or one feels, because you should knock on, put a novel into, get a novel into place in 3-4 years. But short story collections seem to have their own, longevity, their strange genesis, and it's not something one can just necessarily, because it runs deep as the stars.
In a way, it's more like writing, I think there are 11 in here, it's like 11 novels, really, because you've still got to make those people out of nothing.
That's it, out of nothing, out of airy nothing. And you're still, in a short story, trying to give... You do have to do what a novelist does, and we both say this as novelists as well. You have to give the illusion of an entire world, don't you?
Well, you have to know.
You have to know it.
And so, in fact, each of these people... I mean, I could very easily write a novel about each of these people, because I do know who their sister and their mother, and even the things that, you know, so much not in the story that I know about them on those walks when I'm, in fact...
Yes, but you weren't at any point tempted to make this a novel instead?
So tempted.
You were, you
well,
were.
Well, no, not artistically, but so tempted, because publishers, you know, we know that, you know, your publisher sort of looks a little crestfallen and says, but you were contracted to write a novel, and...
you're up and that's a slap.
And...
But you held firm, obviously.
Well, I just, you know, and then other people pointed out that, I mean, some people might have published it as a novel. I mean, I've seen, I think there's a really good book of linked stories came out last year by Daniel Kalman.
Yes.
Is it Daniel?
I think it is Daniel.
Called Fame.
That's right, yes.
And that was published as a novel in 7 stories.
Yes.
And that's quite clever.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, Legend of a Suicide, David Vans, was a bit like that. It was sort of, there is one long, very long story, but it's essentially short stories, but it was that was sort of covered over, and needlessly, absolutely, because the piece, the manuscript is whatever it wants to be, and I think perhaps, you know, now in 2011, we're much easier with, maybe we're less uptight about whether it's a novel, whether it's linked stories, because as someone was saying earlier, I think on the BBC panel, you know, everything is simply story. It's a story, and we get perhaps a little bit too concerned. Yes. So, Mike over here.
So stand up, sorry.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I'm just interested to know whether you've got anything more to say about the relationship between the fact that you're a photographer and a writer, whether... For you, those are two completely different aspects of yourself, or whether there's some linking between them and what that might be.
I don't really think I am a photographer. there are all sorts of things that I do because I love the feeling of focus. I mean, so photography, playing the piano, it feels quite similar to writing, because it just requires a sort of single-minded focus. But the only thing that I feel is really my métier. I mean, I do play the piano every day, and I do take pictures, you know, sometimes every day. But the writing is the thing that feels naturally the thing I should be doing. So it's similar, but not as joyful. And I wouldn't really call myself a photographer.
Really? You really wouldn't? No.
I wouldn't dare. It's so insulting to proper photographers.
Do we have any other questions? Any other questions?
Can I just ask whether your stalking friends realised they were such a source of inspiration?
One of them was in the audience at the Vowood Festival last
year.
And so that's why I hadn't read that story before, and so I thought it'd be very funny because I knew she was there. And so I picked all the bits that were quite seriously related to her. And I mean, she's sort of moved on a bit, so she found it luckily quite funny.
Thing I found myself toying with, that of all the characters, there's one, it's the character who's driving with Morgana, who remains as I, if I'm right. I don't think her name is ever said.
No.
And she's married to Simon, she has 2 sons, Ivan and Angus, and we sort of feel almost like she's the sort of the kind of compass, or the anchor, the centre of it all, although I'm not sure why I feel like that. Perhaps
she hasn't
been named.
Yes.
And that by no means makes her less significant. In some way, it makes maybe like the character in Rebecca, she's more significant, although in other ways nothing like that character. It's just the not naming. I found that intriguing.
Name her.
No.
I kept thinking, even if I don't give her a name in the book, I ought to know what her name is. And
I
don't know.
And you don't know what her name is.
I cannot give her a name.
And she kept really drawing my attention because I think, who's she? Yeah. But at the same time, because you didn't name her, she became a sort of central presence and a strong core for the story. So
she has the final say.
She does.
She sort of is the person who says, it just needs to be good enough. You know, if you seek perfection, it's, you know, you're going to be unhappy. So just kind of count your blessings.
Yes. So would it be too crass a leap, Polly, to say that she is the closest to your own voice?
No, she's not.
Your voice. I mean closest to your own voice in any way. No.
The closest, it sounds ridiculous. Yes. The closest to my voice is the cat. Because there is a cat who speaks, and has something to, you know, he really hates television, and he lectures the family about, you know, how their children's IQs are going to be lowered, and you know, he talks about television as doing for civilization what lead did for the Romans, and that is very much what I say, and so I do feel that he's got my voice.
I think we have time for perhaps one other question, if there is another question. Yes, we do have one just here.
Hi there, Polly. How did you decide when you'd finished exploring this world that you'd created enough and that the collection was complete? At what point did you decide, now it's done?
It didn't feel done, really. It does now, but there were other stories that I had in mind by the point that it became done. And I might still write them. There are things that I know about the characters that are not in the book, and which at the point that I finished it. And what happened was that I sent story by story to my publisher. And I think she decided that it was done. And I looked at it and then thought about, well, I think that, you know, I need one more story. I need to write the story about, it's a story that explains how someone finds out that they have a daughter. And it's hinted at in the book, but it's not written. And then I kind of sat down to write it, and I just couldn't, it was like hitting a wall. I just couldn't write that story. And so that's when I thought, well, it is done. And then I kind of shuffled them around and sort of read it as a whole collection. And I sort of thought, no, that really is complete. And I think it was the right decision, because I hadn't written any more stories that would fit with the characters. It's all pretty random, really. It's nothing is thought out.
No, there is no great, I think. What often assumes that there must have been some, you know, fairly clear and well-informed plan.
If only.
Polly, on behalf of myself and everyone, just thank you ever so much for a fascinating discussion, wonderful readings, and I'll pass to Diana.
Thank you.
Well, obviously I want to reinforce our thanks, our gratitude, both to Polly, and we apologise for compelling you to abandon what you're engaged in currently in order to come here for two events, because I think a lot of you know Polly is then actually the next event going to be talking about Daphne du Maurier's short stories, but we're so appreciative of the fact that you did. It was a stunning reading, and thank you so much, Alison, for so knowledgeably and generously sort of drawing Polly out and giving us a fantastic seminar on the short story. So thank you both very much.